Hey, scientists, how critical is pure water to you? In this new podcast, Lab Water Stories Unfiltered, we at Millipore Sigma look closer at this often overlooked lab essential. Tune in as experts drop tips and insights not found in textbooks, taken from their work with MilliQ Lab Water Solutions. Lab Water Stories Unfiltered. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Millipore Sigma is the U.S. and Canada life science business of Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany.
You're listening to WCOM LP 103.5 FM Carborough and Chapel Hill. It's a Tuesday, it's 5 o'clock, and that only means one thing. It's time for another round of Snarky Faith with your host, Stuart Deloney. This is a space where we irreverently wrestle through life, culture, and spirituality, all with our heads in the clouds, our tongues in our cheeks, our hearts in our sleeves, and our feet on the ground. At Snarky Faith, the questions or even the answers are never the point. It's all about the conversation. So here's your host, Stuart Deloney.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to another round of Snarky Faith. I'm your host, Stuart Deloney, and Snarky Faith is radio for the spiritually disenfranchised. If you've had enough of the insanity in Christianity, well, you've come to the right place. Here at Snarky Faith, we're all about finding a sane faith grounded in reality and working to make the world a better place in tangible ways. We're here to call out religious BS, look for better ways forward, and help you realize that you're not crazy. This religious stuff is completely nuts. You can handle your conversations about faith with copious amounts of
sarcasm
and also a bit of this. Then welcome home. We're glad you're here. This broadcast and all past podcasts can be found at snarkyfaith.com and wherever else you listen to podcasts. We're here, we're there, we're everywhere. Just look for Snarky Faith. Welcome back here again for another week on Snarky Faith. And I am very, very sad today to be the bearer of bad news because right now in our country, we're dealing with an epic problem. Oh, no. Because you know Halloween's coming because, oh, no, it's the devil's birthday. So buckle up, boys and girls. It's going to get bad.
This time of year, fall harvest is heavily celebrated in their household, but Halloween is not.
It grieves me, the thought of exposing our kids to darkness.
Gooch says there's a spiritual war being waged against homes in America.
And if you know the Gooch says it, the Gooch doesn't lie. So we should all trust in the Gooch. Wait a second. If I think back in my foggy mind, back to the 80s, like, come on. Does anybody remember Different Strokes? Come on.
What'd you talking about?
Like Little Arnold, Gary Coleman, Different Strokes. Like, what you talking about, Willis? Like the Different Strokes to rule the world. You know that thing? And I will note that I do sing terribly just for us to be able to escape any copyright infringement whatsoever and has nothing to do with the fact that I am tone deaf and cannot sing. But wait, there is a point here in this, right, Stuart? Different Strokes? The Gooch? Oh, yeah. Somehow it just itched the back of my brain. Yes, Little Arnold on Different Strokes had a bully that was out there that would do as bullies do and bully him. And the mean bully was named? That's right, the Gooch. What does it have to do with anything in this story? Nothing, but it's really awesome when you have some woman that's telling us to worry about... Wait, what are we worried about here, Gooch? Tell us, Gooch. Why are we worried? And who's part of the problem?
Hollywood is part of the problem. And right now, one film in particular.
The whole movie is based on witches harvesting children for blood sacrifices.
In a recent Facebook post, Gooch advises moms against letting their kids watch Hocus Pocus 2.
I believe whatever comes in our TV screens, there are things attached to that. I've seen for myself the things that I've watched with my eyes or heard over a TV screen, they become manifested in real life. Everybody thinks it's fake and innocent, but they could be casting any type of spell that they want to. Anything could be coming through that TV screen into you.
Oh, shit! Does that mean we need to worry that somehow Mike Lindell is manifesting pillows all over America? Oh, the insidious nature of all of this! Curse you, Halloween!
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell.
But yes, it is Halloween. And Halloween is one of those special seasons in the Christian calendar that leads to only the best of the worst. Which brings us to our segment of the week, the Christian crazy! So let's go and descend into it, whether you like it or not.
If loving the Lord is wrong, I don't want to be right.
Lord have mercy. The Lord is my shepherd. He know what I want.
That's right, so hop on in for the best cuts of the Christian nuts of the week. And yes, the only mentions we get of Bette Midler today are Hocus Pocus and There Shall Be No Wind Beneath My Wings. But I do want to feature just a small segment here in the Christian crazy that is officially crazy, but it's actually a bit of truth. Now, it's not truth that you would necessarily want to nuzzle up to and snuggle up to. No, it's that kind of thing where you have people say the quiet thing out loud and you actually kind of get to see their truth, that kind of thing. You know, when Christians do that? Oh, let's hop on over just to a little snippet of Christian crazy truth of the week, because somebody said it. It's horrible, but at least they're owning up to their own horribleness.
In the town of Moscow, Idaho, the fight between church and state is taking a new turn. Residents of this mostly liberal college town are at odds with the pastor of Christ Church, whose mission is to make, quote, Moscow a Christian town. So what does this mean? Well, some basic tenets include the complete submission of women and an unquestioning obedience to authority.
Oh. Does that not sound so evangelical? Does that not sound so conservative, right? Again, we're being sarcastic here. You're listening to a show called Snarky Face. So we're featuring this because it's absolutely disgusting. But it is what it is. And that's where Christianity in many places is today. So let's go ahead and start off with faith-healing grifter Guillermo Maldonado. Now, when we try to think about these guys out there that are bragging, they're prophets, they're pastors, and they've got the powers of God to be able to heal things. Now, Guillermo's gonna fill out one of those little squares that I'm pretty sure was not on your spiritual healings bingo card already. So before we begin, think of a body part. Think of a body part that makes the most sense for God to be able to heal. Maybe someone's sick, something else. Think now in your head. Think of a body part now. And I guarantee you, it's not the one that you're going to be hearing about.
And then he said, tell the people, I want to create new organs. And I call out all the person that need a gallbladder, new knee, and you know, a lot of people came to the altar. And among those people came a lady that her breast, two breasts, had been removed 17 years ago because of cancer. And I asked her, what do you need from God? He goes, I need my two breasts. She fell on the floor. When she got up, she was screaming. I mean, she had her laughing, rejoicing,
Boobies.
Crying. And I say, what happened? She goes, I got my two breasts.
Oh my goodness.
You won't believe what happened last night at church, Becky. I went down forward and I was really wanting to ask God. I wanted to ask God to be able to whiten my teeth, like to whiten my smile so I can be the best me when I'm out there, you know, evangelizing and such. But the Lord overwhelmed me. Yes. Jesus gave me new tits. It was beautiful. I didn't even ask for it. And then the Holy Spirit came along and was kind of like, you want a Brazilian butt lift? Amen. I can't wait to go to the next service when we have vaginal rejuvenation. Praise the Lord. And I'm guessing right now, if you're new to the show, you're probably asking yourself, what the hell did I get myself into? I ask myself that all the time. No, Snarky Faith here is a show where we like to talk about the insanity in Christianity, pointing out where we are getting stuff wrong, pointing out those areas where that have nothing to do with Jesus, and then also try to point us, hey, back to something that's a little more intellectual, something that's a little more aligned with what Christ was talking about. So we dip our toes into the insanity, but then we also hop in and have hopefully meaningful conversations about stuff that's a lot deeper and a lot more meat for us to be able to wrestle with in our own lives. Now, what we're going to be doing today, boys and girls, we're going to be talking with the author of the new book, A Theology of Consent, Mimetic Theory in an Open and Relational Universe. And I really believe this is going to be a conversation I think that you're going to love. So without any further ado, let's hop in right now. Today on the show, I'm sitting down with Jonathan J. Foster. He is an author, a pastor, a podcaster. And what we're going to be talking today about is his new book. Now, it started out as his dissertation, and we're going to unpack this and talk a lot about what is going on in this new book. Yeah, what's going on in this new book? I love it. And so Jonathan's also the author of The Reconstructionist and other books. He's also the guy behind the Jonathan underscore Foster podcast. It's excellent. Give it a listen. You won't be sorry. So Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you. It's really good to be with you, man. I look forward to, figuring out what the heck is going on here. What are we talking about?
I feel like that's me any day. I'm always trying to figure out what's going on.
Right.
Before we get to the book, I want you to talk to us a little about your background and story, because at least when I'm looking into your background a little bit, anyone that gets kicked out of their denomination for loving people and that's all about grace, that's a good soul in my book. So yeah, so give us a snapshot about you and your past and who you are.
Good, good. I thought I liked you for a reason, so I appreciate it. pastor. I grew up, my dad was a pastor, both granddads were pastors. I was steeped in the denominational thing. I kind of found my niche as a church planter, really enjoyed that, was able to hang on the fringes a little bit, and was starting to process life in theology a little bit different, maybe than some of my contemporaries and associates. But really in 2015, we had this major loss in life, and it propelled me. It was like rocket fuel to the whole thing. So I had to kind of, well, I didn't have to. I felt the invitation to rethink some of these things. My old evangelical world paradigm, and by the way, it wasn't all bad. It was a lot of good stuff there. But that paradigm just didn't give me a flexibility to be able to come up with responses that I thought were healthy and life-giving and loving and inclusive. So yeah, I started pulling at the thread. That's where I quickly landed in 2015 on René Girard's mimetic theory. That was super helpful. And then not long after, I got really officially introduced to open and relational theology. That was super helpful. And so the dissertation winds up being like trying to bring those things together.
Yeah, and it is. It's a beautiful way that you try to knit these things together in the process of it. And I think that I think it's going to lead us to have some interesting conversations today. So this came out of what you were doing work. You were doing work at Northwind Seminary towards mm-hmm. your doctorate.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay.
So this came out, and we also know this book is going to be on the shelves soon, coming out to everybody else. So that's excellent. Now, one of the things I did appreciate about this book was your ability to be scholarly, but yet you keep things grounded with your approachable writing style, your humor and humility, I think, and how you just offer yourself up in the process of this. It's deep stuff that you make accessible, and I really enjoyed it.
That's nice. Thank you. That's a huge compliment. I appreciate it. And that is something I worked really hard at, trying to get at some depth, but also not like just get so lost in the weeds that no one understands what I'm saying. So I appreciate that.
Now I feel like I've heard this before, and I don't know who said this, but I jotted it down in my notes here. And I heard this before. It's said, how does it go? It's like scripture is more about humanity and less about God oftentimes. And so I think that there's a lot of that wrapped into what we're talking about here in your book. That is, I feel like it's theological as much as it is like psychological. in many ways.
Yeah, and anthropological.
Yes, that's good as well. Yes.
Yeah, so that would be very Girardian to say that you have to kind of understand anthropology to get theology. But it's also very open and relational to say that too. You know, open and relational loves to say whatever what's going on with God is basically what's going on with the world, and vice versa. So how you love people is how you love God. How you love God is how you love people. So I hope it's psychological, anthropological, certainly ecclesiological, theological. I'd like to think it touches on all those things.
I think it does. I think it really does well. Now, the book's name is Theology of Consent, Medic Theory in an Open and Relational Universe. And the name gives us a bit of a roadmap. Whereas in a portion of the book, you begin by going through and, I don't know, dancing with mimetic theory. Then you're taking open and relational theology and then somehow trying to mix them together and see how the cocktail tastes.
That's right.
Well, it's been a little while since we've talked mimetic theory. And good gosh, I feel like we had Andre Rabe on like a while back. So go ahead and explain to us about mimetic theory.
It comes from the word mimesis, which means imitation. And if you've had Andre on, you know, your listeners should just stop right now and go listen to him, because he probably understands it better than me. But I can run through the basic points. We'll have to skip a few things, of course. But I usually break it down into like four or five categories, and it has to do with desire. So I'll just say them real quick, and then we'll come back and unpack them. Desire, imitation, that leads to conflict. That then leads to the most well-known piece of Girard's mimetic theory, which is scapegoating. And then the last piece, which is the rinse and repeat. It's the ritualization of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So the desire piece is always, it needs to be remembered, I think, played out against this idea that what seems to be true about all of us humans, like a common denominator, is this idea that we're all really aware of our own lack, to use a philosophical term, our own insecurity. We're aware of our own, you know, the places where we've fallen short. And so we seem to have, generally speaking, like this propensity to have shame and to feel a bit like something's not right here, you know. So, and our desires are then born out of that, plus an intense awareness of the desires of the other. So because we live in a relational cosmos, which is what I understand is going on. I think that is the nature of reality. I realize I just threw that out there, but I think that that's what's happening. Because we live in a interdependent, entangled relational cosmos, you know, nothing ever happens in a vacuum. So our desires are what the philosopher might say are mediated by the other. So my desire, I don't know what I want till I see what you want. Mm. You've got a cool beard. I think now maybe I should have a cool beard, partly because, yeah, your beard's cool, but also because there's something going on like at a subconscious level where, because I'm aware of my own lack and I feel like, oh, maybe I don't quite measure up. Man, Stuart looks cool. He is obviously a non-lacking subject. Of course, we don't say these words specifically, but this is how we act. Our entire marketing industry is built on this. You know, the marketing industry doesn't tell you, you know, what kind of car you want to drive. They tell you what kind of car your model wants to drive. Mm. And by the way, the model is always just a little bit better looking, a little bit more affluent. You know, it's got some really good stuff happening for them. It's hilarious because the model goes home at night. You know, they film the TV commercial. They go home at night. They do the same thing. They are now a subject and they're modeling their lives after someone else. So this goes round and round. It's desire and it pings back and forth. Psychological movement is kind of part of the way I talk about it in the book. So you have desire that leads to imitation. And what Girard says is that this imitation inevitably leads to conflict because, well, a whole bunch of different things that we could get into. But essentially our own antagonism we bring into it and our own insecurities. And so now we're all reaching for this thing, you know, and because we're kind of scarcity minded people, conflict grows because I don't want you to get the thing before I get it, because then I may not get it and I may not measure up. And so now we're at the edge of chaos because we're fixing to go to blows. And it's never just about you and me. It's always about the community that we pull in. You've got a community. I've got a community. Everyone's pointing their fingers. And then this leads to, so we got desire, imitation, conflict. This leads to the most well-known piece of René Girard's mimetic theory. And it's this idea that they're at the edge of chaos. Instead of descending over the edge, although sometimes we do obviously do that too, but more often than not, what we do is in a way to process our insecurities and our antagonism, our violence even, we kind of agree together, you and I agree together subconsciously, invisibly somehow, to turn and point our fingers at someone else. And so then we offload, I think that's a good word, we offload our psycho-spiritual drama onto someone else. Mm. So this move of scapegoating, it's always built on two lies. It's built on the lie that you and I are innocent and that the scapegoated victim is guilty. So yeah, desire, imitation, conflict, scapegoating, it's kind of brilliant. I mean, it's sinister, but it's kind of brilliant. And Girard goes into detail about how we've employed this move and we've created the scapegoating mechanism over time and how culture grows out of it and the ritualization of it. And so that's the last piece, is doing it again, because it works. There's peace, but the peace never lasts. It's a fake peace. And so when the conflict builds back up again, we just re-engage, we start over, we do the whole thing, we add some new liturgy, some new prayers, some new songs, whatever, make it our own, and we do it all over again. So that's, I know that's a lot of stuff in a short amount of time, but that's it, kind of in a nutshell.
No, I like that. I like that. It's, you know, that idea, like peace, it's kind of like peace through violence, through scapegoating, kind of how we do that. Now, how do you see this? Now, give us some examples of, like in the political sphere. Where do you see this? Give us an example of how this would play out.
This plays out all the time. Our entire political atmosphere foundation is built upon scapegoating. We tend to choose our leaders, by the way, whether they're political or religious or anything else. And often, as we know, those things just go hand in hand. We tend to choose our leaders based on their ability to get us to air our grievances and to, like, align with the leader in a way that we scapegoat a victim, such that it makes us feel better, such that it allows us to then kind of unify with the group that we want to unify with. So often it has the best political leaders are those who can get us to be mad at someone. And that's how they create identity. And often that's true with pastors too. And I know there's some good churches and some good pastors for sure. But a lot of American Christianity is built on like being more for against something rather than for something. It's just an easier way to build identity. So all that to say, like an example, and I don't mean any disrespect to Donald Trump because I don't know him personally. Who knows? Maybe he's a good guy. I have no idea. But he's really, really good at being able to channel the grievances of people and then to pick someone that everyone else can then be mad at with him. And it's this, it never stops. Social media, of course, doesn't help. I'm not saying that the liberals are necessarily any better. I'm saying Trump is really, really good at this and or bad at this, depending on how you look at it. It goes on all the time. Yeah, all the time.
So us being able to, like, so as you begin to delve into this, you talk about that we're, in a certain ways, we're kind of stuck in this ideological cycle of where we're at. Now, how do we begin to, once we're able to say, I see it, I see this is going on, how do you translate this to how we approach life, religion, God, everything else, as after you see it?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. Once you see this, you can't unsee it. You begin to notice it all over the place. Well, you know, for Girard, for him, eventually, you know, he returned to his Catholic roots and he began to read the sacred text in a way through this scapegoating lens and realizing that the trajectory of the whole word and all the words led to, you know, what Jesus did and who he was and the kind of person that he was and how he was committed to not gaining peace by condemning the victim. He was committed to gaining peace by standing with the victim. And he's like this incredible historical example. certainly incredibly novel for his day. I mean, no one was doing this. Mm-hmm. And still to this day, very, very few people have figured out how to do that. Most of all me, I still struggle with it. So to answer your question, I think there's a lot of ways to do this. It's funny, I've got a little in-person group. We meet a couple of Monday nights a month, and we've been the last few weeks, my talk has been overcoming the mimetic shadow. Okay. And we go for like an hour and a half, and we never exhaust all of it. So I'll throw a few things out there without trying to go the whole rest of the show talking about this. But one thing I think is being self-aware, you know, just being aware that whatever tension I'm feeling, I can't really totally blame entirely the other person because I'm bringing all of my own agitation and frustration. And so when I'm getting upset at the other person, often it's because I'm seeing my own issues in the other person. I'm projecting my stuff onto them. And nothing, frankly, gets me as, you know, angry as when I see my own issues in the other person. Mm. So that's really hard to do. And it takes a lot. Well, it's easy to do. It's hard to admit. It's hard to, you know, be vulnerable. So I think self-awareness is one thing. And the other thing I'll say, there's 100. But the other thing is just trying to get good models in your life, trying to find people who are non-rivalrous and imitate them. Because you're not going to be able, according to Girard, there is no scenario where you are not imitating someone. So if you're self-aware about what you're bringing into the situation, and number two, if you find good models, and I do think that this is the primary role that Jesus then plays for us. He's a great model. And he's got this relationship with his Father God that doesn't seem to be rivalrous. It seems to be very, healthy and close and like Papa Father and relational. So I think those are two things, self-aware and pick good models.
Now, I love how you did that because we're taking that one side. Now we're going to swing it over to the open and relational theology, which is all about Papa now.
That's
from your example there. So,
that's right.
Yeah, good transition on your own. So yes, I want you to then speak a little bit about open and relational theology and kind of unpacking what is that?
Yeah, it's such a different thing than mimetic theory. You know, Girard was this anthropological, the whole thing is about humanity and how we've built culture on violence. And open and relational is just asking different questions, giving different responses. And it's a much bigger concept. So I usually start talking about the relational part first. Mm-hmm. What I think is true, I think the nature of reality is telling us that everything is entangled and interconnected. Scientifically, we've known this for at least 100 years now since theory of relativity and quantum mechanics. We are hopelessly interconnected when you begin to look at those things. It's not a substance-based universe. It's a relationship-based universe. It's not an exception-based universe. It's a exemplification. In other words, you don't come from somewhere else. You know, like there is no real objective point for you to figure out the world. You come from the world. And so what's going on with you is what's going on with the world. What's going on with the world is what's going on with the universe. What open and relational does, it says, not only that, but what's going on with the universe and the world and you is also what's going on with God. And I love that piece of it. It's deeply committed to keeping the divine in a very entangled, interactive thing, very relational, such that in a relationship, people respond genuinely. So God, in this view, is responding genuinely to us. There's a ton of implications, but I'll go with one of them, which leads us to the open part. That is that if God is genuinely responding, what it means is that God doesn't necessarily know what the future is. Because if the future was already predetermined, he or she or it wouldn't, it would just be pointless. I mean, they wouldn't even be invested in anything. They would already know how it's going to go. So open and relational plays out a bunch of these different implications. So it keeps the future open and it says, look, the future hasn't happened yet. It's an unknown quantity. There's a multiplicity of factors taking place as to what, you know, why the future will be what it is. That doesn't mean that God doesn't have probably a good idea about certain things, but in terms of exact details and how that plays out, we'd like to think that there's a genuine relationship going on here. So it's an open future.
And it's an open future that isn't defined by compulsion also. I know like in so many ways that God doesn't push that on us, or he doesn't push his agenda necessarily on us.
Yeah. Right. Because you're exactly right. That's a great way to look at it. If that was the case, then God could really get impatient and be like, no, we got to go this way. You know, you had your time. I gave you a few options. You didn't take it. So now, you know, he steps in space and time and, you know, grabs us and puts us in the right spot. What open relational says is that love, that's antithetical to love. Love doesn't control. And so there's real random chance, real choices, our decisions matter, all that stuff plays into it. And it's pretty fascinating.
Now, I think you mentioned this in the book too. You mentioned that like this dichotomy between these two different ideas too, that there's loving God and a God of love. Can you unpack a little of those?
Yeah, thanks for picking that up. I do think there is it's a subtle difference between the idea of we have a loving God versus a God of love. So, a loving God would be this thing where we have a God who at any given time can reach down to the lowest part of where we are, at any given time can descend down into the depths and be with us. Someone who we could say, really is a friend of sinners, really is close to the brokenhearted. Yes, those things are true. A God of love is already there. He's already descended. It has never left. There's never been a space where a God of love hasn't been. And so it kind of begins to delineate between those two. And it really is it's a subtle, but a huge difference. Because a God of love then is compelled, required. It's a part, that may not be the best word. It's a part of God's essence to be in relationship with us constantly. And so, therefore, he can't choose to not be in relationship. And I find that for me was a helpful way to, I thought that was something healthy that we needed to highlight.
Now, as put on your pastor hat now, switch off from doctor hat to pastor hat. Now, tease out how those two different things look out in practice between people walking out, loving, just having that viewpoint of there's a God of love versus a loving God.
Yeah, that's a good. So what I think is that, your idea of who God is winds up influencing how you interact with people. Mm-hmm. So if you have a loving God, you can be loving, but you also could potentially be, and I'm not saying like necessarily the listener is necessarily doing this. I'm just trying to point out the differences. I think it's super interesting. So if you have a loving God idea, you can want to be a loving person. But normally the way this plays out is there's always a moment when you get to pull the love back. There's always a moment when your love becomes conditional. Mm. You expect the other to meet up to a certain expectation. That's the way that is the bedrock of Americanized Christianity. Mm-hmm. I started to say for good or for bad, but it's for bad.
Yeah.
So there's no reason to say that phrase. So a loving God is great. You can be loving, but you could also not be loving. You could choose not to be loving because you see that your God is doing that. A God of love person decides, okay, the primary thing about my life, which is what I hope is true of me, is what I'm pursuing, is just love, period. And love is presence. I write somewhere else that love is presence, and by our presence, so we love. You know, my kids don't have to do anything. They don't to have my love. I mean, I was shocked as a newborn when our firstborn. I wasn't shocked as a newborn. Well, I probably was shocked as a newborn. Come to think of it, I don't remember. No, I was shocked as a new father when our first kid was born. How like immediately I felt this unbelievable sense of love. She didn't have to do anything. I mean, she was ugly and naked and scrawny. It didn't matter. And I recognized right away how vulnerable I was, which, by the way, is a whole nother tangent to go on. But yeah, it's identifying with love first and pursuing that, and then and not making it conditional. Because if it's conditional, it's not love.
No, you're right about that. That ends up, I've grown up around conservative circles in the past where you end up having like, well, I'm telling you the truth in love, which I'm always like, but wait, why doesn't that never feel like love at all to me? I think yeah, that doesn't even make sense.
Yeah.
But it maybe prints on a t-shirt well for folks. But you're right about that though. And I think that, I know that's a different tangent, we don't have to go down, but that ingredient of vulnerability makes everything different. You know, that ingredient of vulnerability means I have skin in the game too.
Yeah. And sorry to interrupt you. I do think it's possible. And I'm saying this because of what I've felt too, not just because I'm trying to judge others. I do think it's possible that fear of vulnerability is the thing that drives us to, you know, the loving part, loving God versus a God of love. Because then we get to hedge our bets a little bit. We can always pull out if we need to. Mm-hmm. The God of love is at times pure on just complete vulnerability. And it's nuts. It's crazy. It's absurd to think that the universe might be vulnerable, that God might be vulnerable. But I think that's probably true. It's a harder route to go. Yeah.
Now, in your whole process of how did this all come together? Like when did you go, like, I have this idea for this. I have this idea for this. And of course they're going to go together. So what was the process of you being able to pull these two after picking threads and tying these threads together then?
Well, you know, it still remains to be seen whether people actually think that they do go together. So folks will have to read the book to decide for themselves. But I think I started with these two different paradigms, mm-hmm. in part because they were both so helpful for me. I found so much life and insight for me. And also as I was working through them with others, I found, you know, certain lights were going on, and there were a lot of people thinking, oh, this makes, you know, makes some sense. I hesitated there because whenever you're making sense, it feels like you go through confusion first. So mm-hmm. you got to unlearn to get to the learning. But so that's why I started, because they were so helpful. And I intuited that there were probably some common denominators, especially around sacrifice. So that was really meaningful to dive into that piece of it. But in terms of the rest of it, how did I know it was going to come together? I didn't. And in fact, I really struggled. I mean, there were a few months here on the journey where I was like, what the crap am I doing? Because they're so different. And I realized for a while, speaking of vulnerability and being fearful, mm-hmm. for a while I was fearful that, oh my word, I'm going to have to debunk Rene Girard. I can't do that. I can't be the guy. First of all, I'm not smart enough. Second of all, it's just not going to be good for my career. or then for a while I'm like, oh crap, I'm going to have to unfriend Thomas J. Ord. I mean, this is not going to go well, right? But thank God I just kept after it, and I kept not sleeping at night for a while. Mm. And I finally was able to pull it together, even in its divergence. That's what I'm trying to say. There are times when they don't really go together, but I think I figured out a way that each helps enhance and critique the other in a kind of interesting way. At least I'd like to think.
No, I think you have. And I think that going through those, it does seem like that when we stumble onto new things, whether it be, you know, deconstructing to reconstruct or all of these things, we do have those dark nights of the soul or those sleepless nights where we're just like, none of this makes sense. It doesn't fit together. Yeah. But that's the work. That's the process of you like leaning in and continuing to lean in and continuing to do the work with that. So then how does this? How does this begin to get to put together? How does this hold these threads of, how do you get to a theology of consent? So begin to talk about that, because I know you were talking, you were teasing on the different roles of sacrifice in all of these too. So yeah, how did you begin to massage some of these together and see some wholeness and congruency?
Yeah, there's probably a half a dozen different ways to answer that. So I'm trying to, maybe I'll just, okay, well, I can talk about sacrifice for a second, yeah, because that is definitely a common denominator. Both open and relational and mimetic folks, they may not say it this way, but essentially they're all really suspicious of sacrifice itself being a redemptive thing. This was challenging. This is great news, but this is also challenging because it's not as if you can get rid of, let's say, for those of us who care about what's in the Bible, it's not like you can just get rid of sacrificial language. Mm-hmm. So I had to kind of live with that for a while. And where I, and we all know there's a good type of sacrifice, like altruism and self-donative love, those kinds of things, kenotic love, kenosis. So where I kind of landed a bit with that was, I don't remember where I got introduced to this, but this idea that in the English language, that there are such things as reflexive and non-reflexive verbs. Reflexive verbs are verbs where the subject, here's where the consent plays a factor. The subject chooses for themselves to be involved, basically. Non-reflexive is when the subject is being forced into the action of the verb. So as I write in the book, it's a difference between verbing and being verbed. Mm-hmm. No one likes to be verbed. Mm-hmm. So non-reflexive sacrifice is to be verbed. It's this whole idea that God needs you to do something in order to gain his favor. Mm-hmm. Or in the American Christian story, you know, God needs you to do something, but obviously you can't. You can't provide a good enough sacrifice. So he'll send his son Jesus. Jesus gets murdered. Now God's happy. So Jesus took your sins. That's, you know, it's penal substitutionary atonement. It's non-reflexive sacrifice. And both Girard and Open and Relational want to say there's something deeply flawed with that. But reflexive sacrifice, that is the name of the game. That's all about consent. That's all about agency and autonomy and me saying, I get to choose. The church, I say this with all due respect, the church doesn't get to tell me anything. Mm-hmm. God doesn't get to tell me anything. Ultimately, I consent. I am the one who decides. Now, that doesn't mean, I realize the way I just said that could have come across, you know, disrespectfully. That's not the way I mean to take it. It's just a way to try to empower. I think love is constantly trying to empower us in the way that I would love to empower my children and hope that I have. And I hope that they know I believe in them, even when they're making a mistake. I'm not going to force, you know, my will upon them. So that's reflexive sacrifice. That's what Jesus does. Jesus even says one time, I love that phrase, you know, I have the power to lay my life down and I can pick it back up. It's things like that where he's esteeming his own agency and autonomy. And I think reflexive sacrifice helps us get there. And I think that's a really important thing for our world. It's an important thing. I mean, if it's an important thing for me, I say this all the time, as a white, straight, male, American, relatively affluent, to esteem consent, I realize that there's a bit of irony there, because all those boxes I just checked have been the ones primarily responsible for, you know, pushing non-consensual things onto others. So if it's challenging for me, I'm sure it's challenging for folks who don't check off those boxes. And I think it's a great, great word for our world today.
Yes. In so many ways, consent's a great word for the world today. But this theology of consent, where as you've knit a lot of this together, and in your own life, like, how does all, like, where does this lead us? Like, how does this shape us moving
forward? Anarchy. Complete chaos.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, but how does this impact, like, the shape of us moving forward?
Well, I hope it empowers people. You know, I hope it decentralizes. I think that's a great word. I think love is constantly respectfully decentralizing. I think Jesus embodied that. You know, the whole movement of what he's doing subverts the power structures. What are the power structures? They are the structures that have most effectively utilize the scapegoating mechanism, whether it's politics, religion, economics. And so Jesus is always deconstructing that. That's why it drives me crazy a bit. Okay, maybe not a bit. It drives me crazy when you hear preachers of all people who will talk about how selfish deconstruction is and how wrong it is and how, you know, I'm like, come on, man. We're talking about Jesus here. This is deconstruction. That's what it is. So, but it's not deconstruction to be, it's not to like be something inserted into the spokes of the wheel in order to trip people up on purpose, really. It's like this powerful self-empowering agency, consensual kind of thing that always sides with the victim. You know, Jesus was the one who taught us how to get to peace, not by unifying over against the victim, but by standing with the victim. And so what I hope where this leads is a complete overhaul, which is already, it's already going on in many ways. So what I hope this work can do is join with other works in helping people, give them really good theological reasons why to do the things that why we're doing the things that we're doing, because we need to rehabilitate a whole bunch of systematized religion. I don't know if that was a very good answer, but
no, I liked it. I liked it. And it made me ponder too, that since we've talked about different roles that you've had in your life, like if you would have had this, let's say, if this is back in your pulpit days, how would this type of knowledge, how would it resonate with you if you were preaching? How would you be able to kind of shape community around these ideas?
Well, it resonated with me a lot, and that's why I kept running with it, but it did not resonate with the powers. And so the powers are the ones that got rid of me. So there were real world consequences to all this. And by the way, a lot of that, the flashpoint of all that was LGBTQ stuff. It just became easy for the church to scapegoat me for pointing out their scapegoating ways. And so, yeah, I did teach this a lot. And it's really, I've really only not been a pastor, you know, not even a year. So most of my life, that's what I've done. Yeah, it's changed me a lot. It's changed people that I know of who've pursued this. It's affected us a lot. You know, you don't get to pick and choose the victims. You realize you're standing with all victims. I'm rambling a bit, but now I'm tying in, like, the question is, how did this change you? Like, that's one thing. Like, before mimetic theory, I had an idea that God was kind of like with the victim, but I didn't really realize that it was with every victim. I didn't get to pick and choose. It was, so the same issues that are present with, you know, white people victimizing black people are present with males, you know, victimizing females. By the way, they're also present with black people victimizing other black people. They're the same as females victimizing other females, because we all know this goes on. It just never really stops. So I think that was revolutionary for me. And yeah, that was super important.
It is. I always find it interesting, the things that sometimes on these paths of like knowing and discovery, how often us pursuing these things leads us away from the systems and structures of power anyways. It's those difficult lessons to learn. It's almost like, like I remember going through seminary and I was like, I remember someone had asked me, I think like alumni thing, like, oh, tell us about what you got out of this. And I was like, oh, this has been one of the most wonderful experiences that I've had for ruining me for ministry. And I love it. Like, it ruined me for like moving forward, but it also like began to scratch itches and pull threads and move you in a direction. But the sad thing is, I think like you said, like once we kind of begin to see that difference, you just can't go back without probably killing part of your soul.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say that's sad. I don't want to go back because I want to keep moving forward. But definitely what I think is sad is that the system itself cannot see that. They just can't. If they see it, they would have to desystematize themselves and they'd be out of their power. And so it's just like this very ironic hand in glove thing, and it kind of just never stops.
Now, one of the things that we've been talking about here is that as we like approach these and embracing these different viewpoints and how they can impact the way that we see reality, it's inherently it's kind of a journey of risk. I mean, I guess vulnerability, risk, they're very hand in hand. And you said this, and I wanted you to kind of speak more to this. This is one of the quotes I really liked about the book. You said this. You said, "We could be the people who risk with God in the face of the apocalypse, and in the face of apocalypse, rather than the people who trust in a God who authors apocalypse." I was like, it's huge.
That's a pretty cool line.
Yeah. It's yours, so say it.
Okay. That only took me 3 months to write, probably, just that one freaking line. Yeah. So what's the question? What am I thinking?
So yeah, just, I want you to unpack that statement a bit, just unpack that a bit where you talk about, being a people who risk with God in the face of apocalypse rather than a people who trust in a God who authors apocalypse.
Yeah. There's at least a couple things going on. Mm-hmm. The risk piece esteems, again, this vulnerability. It esteems a relational kind of power. That's a big piece of this. It's the difference between authoritative power and relational power. Mm-hmm. And open relational folks want to say that relational power ultimately is stronger than authoritative power. You know, you can tell someone what to do, but if you show them what to do, or you're with them when they're doing it, and you both together, you know, suffer the consequences, that's a much more long-lasting kind of power. So. But it's risky, you know. You got to be really willing to enter it into folks to do that. And it's, to me, it's all about love. I don't think if love is actually true, it's a risk. If it's not a risk, then it's not love, because then it's mm-hmm. controlling. And so, I think that seems to make some kind of sense. And then the second piece of that is the apocalypse part. You know, the Christians have been saying for quite some time, at least the predominant voice has been saying for quite some time, that, you know, it's only a matter of time before the world goes to hell in a handbasket, and that God, like, needs that to happen, or maybe wants that to happen, or that's the way to read, you know, the book of Revelation, which is horrible when you really pause and think about that. Like, as if Jesus came the first time, you know, as this peaceful Messiah, the Prince of Peace. But the second time he's coming back, he's like, well, that first time, obviously that didn't work. I'm coming back now on a war horse, kicking butt, taking names. It doesn't make any sense if you get to say God wants there to be an apocalypse. I don't think that that's the case. I do think an apocalypse, in the colloquial sense we use the word apocalypse, might happen, but it's not going to be because God, you know, needs it to happen. It's going to be because we haven't figured out how to order our societies around anything other than scapegoating violence. And the way to that is to risk. It's, you know, to forgive, which is a huge risk, you know, is to give our lives away in reflexive sacrifice. It's huge risk. You know, it's all vulnerability. And I think that's part of the reason why I'm not so good at it, because I don't want to be vulnerable. I'd rather be in control, you know.
I think that's all of us. But I think that, yeah, over time we begin to realize that it ends up being poisonous too. And especially like that cycle, like the cycle of violence that you were talking about, scapegoating and violence. And it's endless, it's exhausting. And yeah, it ends up kind of leaving us about as useful as like going on a trip on a Ferris wheel. You know, where are we going to go? Exactly where we are now. This is not the best vehicle for moving forward.
There you go. That's a good way of saying it. Yeah.
Well, Jonathan, thank you. Thank you for being a part of this today. Now, if people want to find this book, where do mm-hmm. they go? Is it Amazon and everywhere else we want to look for this? Where can people go and buy this book?
All fine digital retailers everywhere. It's called Theology of Consent, Mimetic Theory in an Open and Relational Universe.
And it is a wonderful read. Jonathan Foster, thank you so much for being on here today. And if people want to find you, if you want to go looking for Jonathan, what do they need to do?
Well, I like to hike a lot. So if they go into the mountains and they just start yelling my name, they might find me.
Okay.
But if they don't want to do that, they can go online to jonathanfosteronline.com. That's the easiest way to connect with me.
Good, good. Because otherwise, I think we're going to have a bunch of people just screaming Jonathan to random mountains.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I mean, it may work. It may
in work. Retrospect, that's not a very good idea.
There's a risk there. There's a risk in this.
You're going to be really vulnerable. Yeah.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much. And again, for those listening to the book, is Theology of Consent, Mimetic Theory in an Open and Relational Universe. This is a wonderful read, and I think it's really challenging stuff that we need in the day that we are in today. And I'm excited to see where the book goes, man. And I'd love to have you back on again to talk about all sorts of things, because the book made my mind go in so many different ways. I loved it.
I really appreciate that. It's been a lot of fun. Yeah, let's do it again.
Awesome, awesome. Thank you so much.
All right, man.
Well, that's all I've got this hour. Much thanks to Jonathan Foster for hanging out with us for this past hour and talking about his new book. Love it. And you guys should check it out as well. And so just before I send you off, a reminder to share, subscribe to the show, and give Snarky Faith a review over on Apple Podcasts. It helps to get the word out to new listeners. If you want to reach out to me directly, you can hit me up at stuart@snarkyfaith.com. That is S-T-U-A-R-T. It's snarkyfaith.com. Thank you for being a part of this show week after week. I appreciate all of you. And as I release you out into the wild, wide world, I send you out with the holiest amount of grace and peace and snark. That's all I've got this week. I'll catch you guys again next week. Peace be with you.
Hey, scientists, how critical is pure water to you? In this new podcast, Lab Water Stories Unfiltered, we at Millipore Sigma look closer at this often overlooked lab essential. Tune in as experts drop tips and insights not found in textbooks, taken from their work with Millicue Lab Water Solutions. Lab Water Stories Unfiltered. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Millipore Sigma is the U.S. and Canada life science business of Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany.